I am going to give you a little quick of an overview of some of the things we do inside cluster management at Google. As John said, I've been working in this area since I joined, which turned out to be about 5 years ago now, and my time has flown over the last little while. So you probably know that we own a fleet of machines whose precise size I'm going to be a little vague about, spread across the globe in a bunch of data centers. And in fact, you can find a map of where those data centers are. Not surprisingly, they're fairly close to where our customers are because we value low latency, and the lower the latency of things we serve to people, the quicker they click and the more money we make. By the way, if you're not doing anything while you're watching this stuff, just click on some of the ads. It will help me. This is not a data center, despite what you might have read recently in the press. This is. This one happens to be in Finland. It was our latest water-cooled data center, seawater-cooled data center. We actually managed to repurpose a 1950s listed building. It was an old printing plant that we managed to gut the inside of and bring back to new life, which is kind of fun. This is what they look like inside. For various reasons, this is not the same data center as that. This one happens to be in Iowa, our latest one. If you count quickly, you could guesstimate roughly how many machines there are inside this, but I'm going to move on. And this is what they look like when you're inside these things. By the way, you can find these pictures on the web. We actually introduced, we asked somebody to come in and take photos of them. The reason I put this one up is to show you sort of how pretty they look and to point out that they will never look as pretty again. As soon as somebody comes along and fixes a machine or changes something or adds a new disk tray somewhere else, this beautiful apparent homogeneity that you see in front of you will evaporate. It turns out we have heterogeneity already, and the different rows of racks will have different kinds of machines in them and different mixtures depending on what kind of workload mix we think we're going to put into the cell. But this is a nice pristine state, which is why we let the photographer in before they allowed any of us access to that cell to break it. So this is again just another picture in the daylight. As you can see, we build our own really lightweight, cheap, nice, simple airflow design machines. They're typically 1U, or they're about 1 or 2U processor cards with, in this case, it looks like there's a disk tray underneath each one. Up at the top is sort of power and network distribution, and if you look a little closely here, you can see some interesting colored marks which represent the fact that different parts of the rack are given different parts of the, given different power sources. So we try and make sure there's heterogeneity of power coming into each of these things. So if something goes wrong, only a relatively small fraction of the whole thing goes wrong. So for us, a cluster is a technical term meaning a set of machines connected by a high-speed network. We use a CLOS network above the top of rack switches. A rack typically contains order of magnitude 80 to 100 machines. You'll get full bisection bandwidth at 1 or 10 gig, depending on the generation, between all of the machines inside that rack. And then there is an oversubscribed set of uplinks to the central magic cluster fabric, which goes whizzo fast. Technical term used by our networking colleagues. Basically, we don't have to worry about where the networking is inside the cluster. We do have to worry about that bottleneck at the uplink. And then the other big bottleneck we have is across the wide area network. So a cluster is a physical construct. And what we then do is we being software types, stick onto this logical constructs. We call them cells. So a cell is just a group of machines we're going to choose to manage together as a unit. Each cell gets a manager. Because we care a lot about failure tolerance, that manager replicated typically 5 ways. We use a Paxos data store to make sure that we correctly update things even when the world is falling apart around our ears. And every single machine in that cell will run an agent that talks to the manager and does things like start this task, kill that other task, tell me what you're doing, are you busy right now, are you healthy, would you mind initiating an OS upgrade, and stuff like that. And the purpose of the manager is there to do allocation of work. So for us, this is just terminology, nothing terribly new for anybody here, but make sure we use the right words. For us, our users, which are people inside Google, give us work in the form of a job specification, which says, here is this job, it contains one or more tasks, and I would like you to run those tasks, please. They usually miss out the please part, but never mind. Think of a task as being like a process group. It runs inside a C group container inside Linux. All of these machines run Linux. There can be one task, or there can be several thousand tasks in a job. You choose. You get to decide when you ask. If you ask for too many, they won't all fit, and you'll end up sitting on a queue waiting to get serviced. If you ask for too few, your work will take longer to get done. So an interesting balancing act. You can actually go look at the state of the cell and say, how busy is it before you start submitting work if you choose to. What kind of things do people give us? Well, here's a little graph of how long jobs run for between when they get submitted to us and they get started and when they exit. And there are two kinds of jobs, as you can see from this trace, and we've deliberately separated them by solid lines and dotted lines. The solid line, so this is a CDF on the y-axis, and the x-axis is the log of the runtime. So the solid lines represent batch jobs. A batch job is something you submit, it produces a result, and if it succeeds, it exits in a good way. That's success. Those things tend to run reasonably short. So the sort of median batch job here looks like it's in the few minutes range. It turns out the median for various kinds of things for an individual task is less than a minute. There are a few which go on for quite a long time, a few days up here, so that tail turns out to be an interesting case. This is data from a cell I'll talk about in a minute. The service jobs, which is the other kind of jobs that most people provide, are, imagine them as things like you want to bring up Google Docs, or you want to bring up Gmail, or you want to bring up web search. You want to come up and stay up, basically indefinitely, until you decide you want to do an upgrade of the software. So as you'll see on the CDF, there are things over here, the graph is still running, right? The only reason it stops at this point is that we terminated the trace after 29 days. So these things were presumably still running before we started and will continue to run after this trace was. And this is a 29-day trace from May 2011. So the message you get from this is that the batch jobs are relatively short and service jobs are mostly very long. Some of them fall over very quickly. That's typically because there's something wrong with them or somebody's doing some testing and you want to bring it up, try it, tear it down again, repeat. How often do they arrive? Well, it turns out, as you might expect, because service jobs have run for a very long time, thankfully, they don't come very often. So this is the same kind of graph of interarrival times between jobs. And service jobs arrive relatively rarely, every few minutes, or roughly about once a minute. Batch jobs, on the other hand, just come, they come, they come, they don't stop coming. So one way to think of this is we've got lots and lots of smallish batch jobs coming, and they get processed, they exit, and they move, and then the next one arrives. And the service jobs sort of sit there like big boulders and just consume resources in the cell, and you have to schedule the small batch jobs around them. And in fact, that's exactly what we see. So here are three different cells, lovingly called A, B, and C. If any of you have seen some of my prior work, you'll find C is the trace, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, that you can download yourself and actually go poke around and see what happened in that cluster. This was a median size cluster in May 2011. It had about 12,500 machines in it. B is interesting just because it's one of our bigger clusters. Otherwise, as you can see, there's a bit of heterogeneity. So the way to read these graphs is you look at each of these vertical bars and they represent, you know, what fraction, that solid bar represents what fraction of whatever the thing at the bottom says is related to batch jobs. So on the far left-hand blue thing, you'll see about 95-ish% of all jobs are batch jobs in cell A. 99-point-something% of all tasks in that cell are batch tasks. However, only about 25% of the CPU resources are used by batch tasks. So in that particular cell, almost all jobs are batch jobs, almost all resources are consumed by service jobs. It varies a bit, as you can see, across different cells, so this sort of variation is fairly typical. But the general mantra is, you know, there's lots of small things and they flit in and out, and there's a few big things and they sit and chunk and use stuff is probably correct. Interesting tripod. Our job in the cluster management, the first thing we have to do is we have to take those incoming requests and find places to run them. So it's a bin packing problem. We've got resources, these machines. They have CPU, they have memory, they have disk capacity, they have disk access time, they have network bandwidth, and possibly a couple of other things besides. Sorry about that. And what you want to do is you want to use them up in such a way you run out of everything at about the same time. Right? There's no point in using up all the CPU in one of them and leaving a few gigabytes of RAM sitting around doing nothing. There's no point in using up all the RAM and ending up with a bunch of CPU that you can't take advantage of. So what we try to do is to end up with as little as possible of the two things or the four things or the five things, depending on how many dimensions you want to take into account when you're done. I should have said also that the other thing you can specify when you supply a job, you can say things like, I want to constrain the placement of the tasks in this job. Please make sure that, for example, they all run on an x86 machine. Well, it turns out all of our machines today are x86 machines, so that doesn't help very much, but there was a time when that might not have been true, and there may be a time in the future when it is not true, so, you know, good precaution. You can also say things like, please don't put more than 5 of these tasks in a single rack in case the rack stops working, and I don't want to lose a bigger fraction than that of my total workload, or workload processing capacity. So the next slide shows you, for that particular cell, that was cell C in the previous graph, how do we do? So this shows, there are actually two sets of graphs here. So the x-axis is time, 0 to 29 days, and the y-axis on the left-hand side shows how much CPU and how much memory is actually being used, consumed by tasks running on those machines. And on the right-hand side is how much memory and CPU we allocated to those tasks. You'll notice that we allocate more CPU than we have. This is not a mistake, because otherwise this thing would be even lower. You notice we're not quite so aggressive about allocating more memory than we have, because it turns out if you run out of memory, it's really painful. If you run out of CPU, you just go a little slower for a while until we decide to throw some one of you off. We can talk later, if you care, about why it is that we have a fair amount of slack left over. But it is not entirely accidental. So you want to try it yourself? Great, you're welcome to do so. You can download those traces that I just described for every single job request, every single task placement decision we made, every single machine arrival and departure and rebooting and breakage that happened during the month of May 2011. And for every 5 minutes, we will tell you the mean and max usage of memory, CPU, and all those other things for every single task on that cell. It's only about 40 gigabytes compressed. Feel free to download it. You can search for this, my name, and this stuff. Knock yourselves out. Can you do better than we did? We would love to know. Give it a try. If you do, please let us know. There's a bunch of people who've sort of looked at this stuff and done some analyses. Not many of them have been brave enough to actually try writing a scheduler yet. We wish they would. We hope you do. It turns out, though, although I say this is the main thing we worry about, it is not the only thing you have to worry about. So I'm just going to give you a few examples of some of the other stuff that cluster management does for us inside Google. And I'm just going to use as an example, because it fits and it's nice and short, GWS, Google Web Search. I am lying through my teeth when I show you a simple rectangle associated with Google Web Search. You just assume that for the moment. But pretend, for the sake of discussion, that the guys who run Google Web Search want to submit a set of requests to the cell in which they run. What has to happen in order to be able to make that so? Well, the obvious thing is they have to describe what it is they want to run, the jobs and their tasks, that's a configuration, and we have to communicate that somehow to the cell master, which will then talk to the agents on the machines where it's going to run. So you've got to put the job config somewhere. Well, first of all, great, so you need a couple of storage systems. You need one where we actually tend to store this kind of stuff in our source code control system so people can stare at it and see whether they think it was right. And then we have a sort of production system which is drawn, pulled from by the master. And for the purpose of discussion, we're going to call that Chubby today, which is our standard file system and lock server. Chubby turns out to have scaling issues, so we put caches in front of it to make it go faster. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, each of these boxes is another service that is running in clusters on top of cells like this. There is a little bit of circularity here. We have bootstrapping tricks. But each of those things is going to want similar kinds of configuration information that needs to be described to the rest of the system. We have a lot of very bright people working very hard to make sure this doesn't go crazy wrong. The system itself, the cell itself, needs describing which machines belong to which cell. Who should be allowed to use how many of those machines in that cell today? Should we allow ads to take over every single machine in the fleet, or should we actually serve real users with interesting data, like contents of web searches? We'll talk about this in a minute, but we run a number of different monitoring systems. We care a lot about what is going on inside the cells, so we measure a technical term, boatload, of things that happen on every single task. Every single task, it turns out, is a little miniature web server, so you can go pull information from it about what it is doing, what its RPC stack is like, what kind of requests it has been having, how fast they are coming, how long they took to get serviced. That just gets built in for free in our standard libraries, and means you can actually go out and look and see what happens, which is great, but now you need to aggregate that, so you need another server which collects all of those things, pulls them together, and then you need another server which will actually display that stuff for people to look at and understand. And in order to be able to run stuff, you have to be able to take some bits, write your program, and stick it into a file system in a format that is compatible with a package that can be downloaded and pushed out onto a number of machines. Imagine somebody says, let's start a 2,000 node MapReduce job. Perfectly normal thing to do, not a big deal. That does, of course, mean once you decide where you're going to run it, you need to get 2,000 copies of your binary to those machines quickly, because it might only run for a few minutes. Turns out the smallest, the joke internally is that Hello World is about 3 gigabytes, because we statically link. Slight exaggeration, it's only about 64 megabytes. So the majority of MapReduce jobs turn out to have about 64 megabyte binaries. Okay, let's make 2,000 copies of them now. No rush. Here's a system that helps make that happen. I am told that security is a good thing. I'm not a security person. I'm happy to believe that they are correct. And there is lots of clever stuff taking place with key distribution, making sure that we allow people to SSH into only the machines in which they are actually have executing binaries, and other good stuff to stop bad stuff happening if anybody is foolish enough to make a mistake. It's very hard to tell the difference between malicious and incompetent. And then finally, we want to make sure that we have kept track of what it is that we've done. We've made sure that the right people are using the right resources for the right thing. So there's an accounting system, which itself uses data that comes out of the monitoring system and out of the central cluster manager in order to keep track of which resources are being used for where, and by the way, what's going to be happening to those resources as we look to the future and start planning whether we need another new data center or when we need another data center and where it should be. I touched on this about monitoring. If I want you to remember anything else, it's two things about this talk is failures are the norm, and if you're not monitoring it, it is out of control. You guys, of all people, probably know this better than most. So we monitor stuff a lot. This is just a quick snapshot of, I picked up yesterday or the day before, of what is going on about the RPC latency for the master. So we have service level objectives, and I put this in just to keep John happy, because he and I was initially talking about SLOs. Service-level objective, something you wish to be true. If you don't meet it, somebody will be unhappy, but you don't know how unhappy. But it's still useful to be able to know roughly what it is your expectation is, because then the people who use that service can start writing code in order to conform to it. Here's a few of the things that we publish as what you can expect in terms of performance and related numbers associated with those cell masters. The numbers don't actually matter. Uptime, we're trying to get better. Max outage duration, we're kind of get smaller. That turned out to be hard. Average outage duration is very short because we have this automatic Paxos failover stuff, but maximum one is when it goes pear-shaped. And you have to worry about that. And this graph here just happens to be for some RPC. It's a mutating RPC, which means doing a write, basically, down to the master, causing it what is it is. The purple and the blue lines are, the 95th percentile for across the fleet, and the other lines are particular cells that look like they're doing a little worse than we would like them to do. The other thing we do, which is different than most people, is you've probably heard that we don't use virtual machine technology for the majority of the stuff we do in-house. VMs are great. They let you migrate things. They give you a boundary on which to control stuff. But it turns out that boundary is almost as good from C groups and a bit of clever games with Chroot. But they also impose a little bit of overhead. By a little bit of overhead, I mean a few percent of runtime overhead. Well, a few percent of runtime overhead is another data center or two. $100 million there, $200 million here, you're talking about real amounts of profit pocket change. So we would much rather not spend that to not get the benefit. But we have another trick. If we need to migrate something, we have to write, or our developers have to write software that copes with failures. Stuff breaks all the time. So what do you do to migrate something? You simulate a hardware failure. You kill it in place A, and you bring up a copy in place B. It already had to handle that case anyway, so no extra code is required from the developer. And it gives us a way to migrate stuff around. Yeah, it's a little expensive, and it would be nicer if we were to be able to do it gracefully. But in practice, it works remarkably well, because people have to write systems which will handle that kind of behavior anyway. However, we do make promises about the rate at which we're willing to do this. And we also try to make promises about how many of your tasks in a job we will take down simultaneously. So those are the limits you see down here on the evictions restrictions. So that helps people actually observe the system. Turns out we found it useful to write these things down. I'm talking to guys who care about SLOs a lot, because if you don't write it down, they will measure what they get and treat that as a requirement. It might be better this week than you plan it to be next week. So if you want to make next week worse than this week, you had better tell them that next week is expected to be worse than this week, and you may as well publicize your expected goal for the whole year rather than let people find things. What we find is that most people do not complain when service gets better, but if it goes the other way, you hear from them. Okay, So as you notice, we've been running a company, and it turns out the vast majority of the stuff we do sits on top of this cluster management system that we have now. For various complicated reasons, I choose not to name it. The cluster management system that shall not be named. And that's too long a name, so we wanted to change the name, and the best way to change the name was to build a new one. So around about 4 years ago, we started going, we're getting worried about the current system. Turns out the current system is now almost exactly 10 years old. We found the first piece of code checked into it last week, 10 years back. At Google, that's three lifetimes. This is unusual for us to have something last this long. So it's well past the time it was due for replacement. And there was a couple of other technical reasons that were good reasons for going to do it as well. The first was that the workload on the manager is roughly proportional to the number of calls in the cell. And the number of calls per machine is going up, and the number of machines per cell is going up, both fast. That was disconcerting, always worth sitting back about 3 or 4 years ago, looking to the future and getting worried, because the old one had some bottlenecks that made it go slow at times. The second was the old one, although it was a wonderful piece of code, and it was actually a spectacular technical achievement by my colleagues, who have since departed the company for other reasons, it is perhaps best described as having experienced organic growth, otherwise known as spaghetti code. So it made it really hard to add new things. And we have lots of people saying, could you really need this new feature to be able to roll something out? Could you guys add Flash support, yesterday? And the answer is no. So we burnt a lot of people inside the team trying to keep up with stuff. So the thing is inflexible. It also meant that because it was complicated and hairy, it was really hard to bring new team members on and have them be productive quickly. So it's sort of double whammy. Not only can you not make progress with what you've got, you can't bring new people on and bring them up to speed because of the internal complexity. So, and just to help you give some idea of what was going on, the left-hand one is the number of RPCs we offered to that master, and sort of each one corresponds to a new set of functionality we were offering. And then the right-hand side, there is the number of protobuf fields, or think of those arguments, if you like, to the union of the arguments to those RPCs. It has been growing continuously over there. What's entertaining is that we've had a moratorium on new fields and RPCs since 2012. Note the spectacular flattening out of these curves at the top right-hand corner. Okay, so we did what any good computer science group would do. We said, let's build a new one. The second system, for those of you who know Fred Brooks, should resonate very nicely. And we have a set of kitchen sinks, and we're going to drop them into the system. It's not quite as bad as that. We were aware of this issue. Our particular goals we wanted to do was to make it for ourselves to be flexible and for our users to give them much more predictability than the current system. The current system behaved well, thanks to my SRE colleagues who very carefully constrained its behavior by limiting the bad stuff that its users would do to it. But it's always felt a little fragile, and we would like to have some more intrinsic controls inside the system. We'd also like the thing to be easier to use. So Omega is actually in the process of being rolled out right now. So Omega is the name of the new system, and has a cute little logo. It's being deployed. It turns out we're finding ways to deploy it in stages, so we're not doing one big bang. It would be awkward to change the engines on the plane while it is flying from propellers to jet simultaneously. It's easier to do a little bit at a time. So here's what Omega looks like inside. At the bottom are a set of machines. Each of them runs an agent for various complicated reasons, because somebody came up with this name one day. They're called omelets, to distinguish from the old agents, which had a different name. In the center is this thing called cell state. It's also a persistent Paxos store replicated five ways, and it contains a description of what is happening on those machines. It's our current best knowledge of what either is happening or should be happening on those machines. It's not truth. Truth is what's on the machines. This is a distributed system. You can't ever know truth. You can only know what you think you understand about it. So I sometimes call this faith, your belief about what is happening on the machines. And what you would like to be happening on the machines, some people call beauty. So it turns out that not shown here is a connection. There is a thing that looks at cell state, extracts beauty, and tries to make truth correspond to it as fast as it can. And when it discovers things out there that are not represented by what you believe, it updates faith to correspond to reality. Usually a little late, such is life. And then on top of cell state run a number of what are lovingly called scheduler verticals because of this picture. The verticals, they are tall things. A scheduler contains at the top of it, imagine something like a mission control system, and at the bottom of it, the decision-making engine that decides which tasks you go on which machines. So why would we do this? Why not just have one, which is what we used to do? Well, it turns out that you end up wanting different properties. If you're trying to run a batch job that's going to run for 37 seconds, you do not want to spend 2 minutes doing an optimal placement of its task to be completely fault tolerant. It ain't worth it. Just find the first places it'll fit and say go. If you want to run something for 6 weeks, and it would be awkward if that thing stopped running, you actually are willing to pay a minute or two of computation time to decide what the best place is to cope with a number of different correlated failures, for example, in the power system. Those two pieces of code turn out to be not the same. And we were finding ourselves with one algorithm that was trying to do two things, and it was getting more and more complicated to extend it and add features and functionality. That was one of the reasons why we were pushing back on our internal customers, saying, no, you can't have that because it's too complicated. But what we could do now is we could build a specialized scheduler for the service jobs, a specialized scheduler for the batch jobs, and it turns out there's another interesting thing we get to do, which is we upgrade operating systems at regular intervals, think every month or two, because we can. So that means we get to reboot them, and they will go down for 30 seconds or so, or a minute if you're unlucky, while it does that upgrade. And that's a scheduling event, right? We would like to be able to say, let's place it on the machine at a time when it's going to cause the least amount of damage. Let us remember those SLOs that we specified in terms of the number of things you could evict simultaneously. Let's try to schedule these reboots around those SLOs so we don't violate the promises we've made. So scheduling disruptions is a scheduler. Everything in this world is a scheduling event, which turns out to be a rather nice way of unifying a whole bunch of other things. Over here, sort of cell reconfiguration is the process of adding and removing machines to the cell. Well, guess what? You can decide when you're going to do that based on when you think you're going to have enough notice to give to people if you want to take stuff away. So you can, for example, if you know a couple of racks are disappearing, you can plan for that ahead of time and migrate the work that was currently on those things away from those racks, gently, slowly in the background so that you don't have to violate the SLO promises that we've made. That's why everything is a calendar, everything is a scheduling event, and we also have a calendar that lets us look into the future. This is a big change from the current system, which only knows about right now. It has no notion of tomorrow. You can ask it, can I fit this immediately? And the answer is yes, no, maybe. And you can answer about tomorrow, and it says, I have no idea what you mean. We think this is going to give us much better predictability properties for our users, because they can actually look ahead to see what's coming down the pipe and work out how to schedule around it. Cell state is deliberately as minimalist as we can make it. We want to push all of the policies up into the schedulers. We want to allow ourselves to come up with future wacky policies that we don't yet fully understand. So, and we also want to be very clear that we don't want each of the schedulers to understand the other scheduler's policies. So the only thing that goes in cell state is the minimum necessary information about what decisions have been made to put stuff on machines in order to communicate those decisions, not the reasons for the decisions, just the decisions, to the other schedulers. So it has no policy inside cell state other than you can't put more stuff onto a machine than will fit. I'm eliding some details about we have some ways of expanding machines, but first of all, think of it as what we call feasibility. You're only permitted to do legal things, and if you try to do any legal thing, we'll bounce it back and say no. But that's the only thing, only policy we impose. So one of the questions you might ask is, great, so we have this state, we have these updates, sort of how do you do your updates? So we did a little performance experiment with some simulation studies, and this is done by a couple of students of mine that came over, one from Cambridge and one from Berkeley. And the details of these graphs don't matter very much, other than let me give you two things. You know, up is bad, red is very bad. That's all you need to know for the point of this discussion. So here is sort of where we started from today, with one scheduler that takes the same amount of time to do stuff for batch jobs and for service jobs. And this is clearly very bad. It's got tinges of red at the back, and it's way high. Not good. If you special path the batch jobs, then you can actually do better, but you still have, effectively, think of this as this non-zero portion down here as equivalent to head-of-line blocking. You can get stuck behind a service job, which might take a few tens of seconds to service, and you've got some poor user going, where's my job, where's my job, where's my job? So that was sort of monolithic schedulers, which is our current system. It's also pretty much what Yarn uses, those of you familiar with Yarn, which is a new resource manager from Yahoo. Our intellectual competition is a project called Mesos, which comes out of UC Berkeley, and that has a different way of doing, they call it a two-level system. Instead of having a passive underlying store, they actually have an active resource manager down there which tries to do as few policy choices as possible. But because of the way they implement the access to the decision-making in the schedulers, they're basically doing pessimistic locking of all of the resources while the scheduler makes its choice. Two things to notice about this. One is that it's down. This is good. The second is that it is all red. What this means is for the workloads we were throwing at it, there were jobs left on the table that it couldn't schedule. This is not good. technical term. I would not be showing you this picture if I did not have a better one. Guess what? Omega does well. So we managed to get basically the performance, the best of the case performance you'd like to get out of the monolithic scheduler special cased with, as it turns out, and if you're interested in this, we can actually get scalability. We did some experiments with running 32 parallel batch schedulers, and it works just fine. So what we do, which is different than other people, is we have an optimistic concurrency protocol, much like lifted from the database folks. So we basically get a copy of cell state, do our thing, and then try to push down the changes. And most of the time, if you're smart about the way you make those initial decisions, the number of conflicts is very low, and you don't have to redo much work. And this study was basically to try and find out whether that was true. And the fact that it's all the way down here almost all the time says, yep, we got away with it. I mentioned this notion of being able to add new scheduler types. So this is another thought experiment we did, again, another simulation study. What would happen if we added a new scheduler that knew about map-produced jobs? Now, we're not the first people to have thought of this, but in our context, we have now a vehicle to do it in. And you come up with a map-produced job, and what happens today is that people pick the sizes of map-produced jobs. How many workers should I have? This is a graph of how many workers people request for their map-produced jobs across the entire fleet. And so I'm probably back in May 2011. Notice the careful hand-tuning of the number of workers to the precise best value associated with getting a piece of work done in unit time. Why do all of those numbers end in zero? 100, 200, 500, 800? Well, you know what happens? People don't actually care about working this calculation out. They find something that works, and they get it done, and then they move on to the next thing, and they just leave it alone. We push them into this awkward position. They have to choose a number that's big enough to get stuff done in time, but they need a small enough number that it will fit inside the cell. Well, the amount of stuff that fits inside a cell changes from the time of day, depending on what other people are doing, and whether it was still the same cell they were using last week. This is crazy. Why do we get people to do that? Well, the answer is they don't. Why don't we have machines do it instead? So if we were to show up inside the cell and the scheduler could say, you know, this job is almost entirely maps, and there's a little bit of reducing at the end. If we scale it up, it'll go faster. And we've got spare resources. As you saw from that utilization graph, we typically have half the time, we have half the resources unused. Great. So we did that study. And this is a CDF of the result. So the x-axis is how much faster did map-produced jobs go on. It's a log axis. Good news is that none of them got slower. Whew, do no harm. Second is 30% of the map-produced jobs has zero effect at all. Absolutely nothing. Didn't help. But that still leaves 60% where things got better. And they got better a lot. You should not believe this stuff on the far right-hand side, because there's a simulation study. It's unlikely we're actually going to get 100x speed-ups. But even if we compress it a little bit, it's still entirely plausible to get 3 to 4 times faster on average for map-produced jobs, because the resources are just sitting around idle, because we need them to be there in case Michael Jackson comes back to life. And you all go and touch the website and go, what the fritz is going on? When he first died, I use the phrase carefully, We saw what we thought was a denial of service attack. But we served it because we had the capacity to do it. That's one reason why we have that spare utilization. It's there in case there's a massive, great big peak of stuff. So this is pretty good. And we couldn't do this in our old system because the software engineering challenges were just too high. But in the new one, we can actually go build, and we're in the process of doing this right now, let's build a specialized scheduler which understands map reduced jobs and their properties, because you can predict whether it's worth giving them extra resources or not. Great. Something I didn't mention, I should have done earlier, is that we run different kinds of jobs on the same machine. The thing that runs Gmail or Google Docs or web search might also be running MapReduce jobs for all sorts of different things. It might be doing video transcoding and stuff like that. So these are two graphs, again, CDFs, of how many tasks does each machine get to see. And the median one is around about 10 tasks, so 10, imagine 10 different jobs running on the same machine. This number is going to get bigger as we get more multi-call systems that have more calls in them. It's not going to get better. And then the bottom one is how many threads we are executing simultaneously. All I can say is that my developer colleagues are thread nuts. They're like asynchrony. Okay, fine, good. There's some consequences of this. If you've got multiple independent tasks running on the same machine, might they not interfere with each other? Well, of course they interfere with each other. So this is a graph of some random job, I actually don't know which one. It had about 400 workers in it, and we just plotted what was the CPI that each worker saw. So cycles per instruction. Basically, the more cycles per instruction you have, the more you're getting interference from things like L3 cache collisions or back-end memory bus overloads, and basically sort of other people interfering with your stuff. And you get a slightly skewed normal distribution. It's never going to go very far to the left because the things don't go infinitely fast. But the far right-hand side tells that some poor sods out of your set of tasks are really suffering. They're roughly running at a half to a third of the speed of the ones near the midpoint of this curve. So we actually do this. We gather this data across all of the tasks of various different jobs. It has to be per processor type. It has to be per version of the job because it stuff like that. We look at all this stuff, and then we find these guys in the bottom right-hand corner and say, can we help? And there's a couple of things you can imagine doing to help. One is killing it, because then you can resurrect it and bring it to life somewhere else where hopefully it won't hurt so much. And the other is you can look around to find what's causing the problem. And this paper that's listed at the bottom here turned out did the latter. What it looked for was, can I find some batch jobs whose CPU usage correlates nicely with the increase in the CPI of the victim? And if that's true, then the batch job is probably the culprit. Kill it instead. And so there's a paper describing how to do that. So again, you know, tail behavior is worthwhile paying attention to. At this kind of scale, you always have tail behavior. Let's see what you can do to scrunch things in and make things more predictable and more reliable. So it turns out over the years, we have built this spectacularly sophisticated system that was driven in many ways by the requirements of our really big internal customers. The top five or six properties inside Google, applications, things like Gmail and web search, consume something like 70 to 80% of the resources in the fleet. And it's worthwhile giving them every single knob that they can think of, at least we thought it was, in order to be able to make their systems more efficient, because they have a small army of people working out how to use those knobs and making them efficient. So we built this gorgeous system on the left-hand side, which actually is a picture of cooling tubes. Yes, the internet does run in tubes. When most people, and it turns out, the majority of developers are not on those really big systems. They're doing all sorts of other stuff. They're much smaller. Their resource requirements are tiny compared to the big ones. And they just want to get on their bike and run and have a good time, go off and do stuff, and get on with whatever it is their production system is trying to do. And yes, this is an adult-sized bicycle. So we're actually, right now, going back through a retrofitting exercise or a change exercise. How can we make things simpler for people, not more sophisticated? The guys who are curver, they can have every single knob they like, knock themselves out. Everybody else, how can we take away the need for understanding all of that piping in order to be able to get them to dust, get their work done? So here's one reason why that's hard. This is a graph of how many CPU cycles in blue or how much RAM memory in red we needed. This is just sample data from some random workload. I don't know what it is, some web surfing thing probably, as a function of input load, queries per second. See the simple linear models that correspond to increasing load means more CPU. Well, it looks like there might be. There's a few. Perhaps these have to do with different processor types. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they're different versions of the software. We have no idea, right? And neither do most of our developers. And nor do most of our developers have time to work out why. The memory case is even weirder, right? It's got these striations. What on earth is going on there? We don't know. But why should people have to do this? And the answer is, they don't, right? You can throw this at machines. Machines can say, let me give it some memory. If it works, great. If it doesn't work and falls over because it runs out, let me give it a little more memory. Repeat. Remember, they have to be able to cope with things failing anyway. So we can actually automate the process of doing what we would used to do, which was to make people tell us all of these parameters about how much stuff, how many resources going to use. We don't have to. We can have the system do it for you. So the goal we're trying to get to is this one. Here's my binary. Run it. I don't care how many copies you make. Make enough. I don't care where you make your copies. Make them in the right places. I don't care how rapidly you ramp them up. Do whatever you think is right to cope with the expected and observed workload curve changes you've seen in the past. All of that stuff can be automated, we think. The trick turns out to be not can you do this at all, but it turns out to be relatively easy to do it for the people with relatively small requirements. I don't know how many of you have used App Engine, but that turns out to have a very locked down execution model. And you can do so. Think of this as App Engine for the people inside Google. The difference about between App Engine and the people inside Google is that App Engine locks down deliberately what you can access from the outside. There's a small set of services you have access to, plus the external web. People inside do not like restrictions of that general form. So it's easy to cope with the people that don't use anything. It's really easy to cope with the people who have used everything but have teams of people to deal with it. It's the ones in the middle, each of which has a different set of features they would like to explore in order to make their binary just run and work. But anyway, it's a currently work in progress, and this is what we're at to, what we're working on. One of the things that's interesting, of course, is that, like any automated system, it sometimes doesn't do what you want. And then it turns out the majority of the traffic on our users group to our internal customer management system team that should not be named is, why didn't my program run? And so people have to work around, look at the logs, and it turns out that the system knows why the program didn't run. It's just the way it tells people they can't understand. It's using reference which are associated with its own internal machinations and decision-making and stuff, which is complete noise to the people from the outside of the system. Imagine if you press your foot on the accelerator on an automatic and it didn't speed up. And the little light flashed up on the dashboard to say, I'm sorry that the pressure inside the exhaust manifold is 3% higher than it was planned to be, so I decided not to do that. Huh? That doesn't help, right? So we need to find some way of translating the things the way we say we don't understand how to do that or we can't do that into actionable recommendations to people. It's not, why didn't it run? They don't actually care about that. What they want to know is, how do I make it run? And we need to find ways to do that. Let me give you a particularly strong example of that as a thing to end on. So for some reason, best known to people in this room probably, all pagers go off at 3 a.m. I have no idea why. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that my SRE colleagues are spectacularly competent whiskey drinkers, and 3 a.m. is the most unpleasant time to remember that fact the following day. So you get woken up. These guys have about 15 minutes to respond before he or she gets a chance to say, okay, panic. And the first thing you want to know while the coffee is working its way through to their system is, are we in trouble or is this a false alarm? False alarms do happen. They are dealt with severely the next morning by the developer that is taken out to lunch and never spoken from again, or until they fix the problem and the alarms don't come back. More interesting though perhaps is, it may be that the system is going, I think I'm about to be in trouble, but now you need to know how soon. If it turns out that it's 8 hours from now, go back to sleep. We can deal with it then, when we're awake and sober. If it's right now, okay, I need to know, I need to panic. What you actually want to do, though, is you want to give these people some advice. The system is confused about what it is doing, or it has not confused at all, but it is way outside its pay grade for making an automated decision. But it probably has some ideas of things you should try first. It might even be able to stack rank them and say, I recommend this, but there's a 20% chance it would be exactly the wrong thing to do. What you want to do is have people at this point focus on making the decisions that the system can't, but you need to present information to them in the way that they can take advantage of, and we're not very good at doing this yet. And as we move towards more and more automated systems, this is going to become more and more important to find ways to do this stuff. So this is currently still an open problem. Would love to hear from you people about how you think we might be able to do better. We'd even encourage you to work on it in your own environments, because I think this stuff is going to be incredibly important going forwards. Okay, so putting all this stuff together, summarizing, this stuff is a blast. It's fun to go work in this kind of environment. These toys are better than other people's toys. Just for entertainment, I ended up talking to one of my office mates a couple of weeks ago, and he was doing some performance improvements and stuff, and he said, you know, if we do this right, I think we could save 50 petabytes across the fleet. And I do not remember which of us said this, but one of us said to the other, is that a lot? It turns out 50 petabytes is a lot. 5 is not. If you think of what does 5 petabytes cost in terms of the number of software engineer years, it's not very many. That's not a big decision in a company which employs 30,000 people. 50 petabytes turned out to be above threshold and worth paying attention to. But scale itself turns out to be the most interesting thing. Scale is interesting because of what it causes you to be exposed to, which is the tail behaviors, and in particular, failures. Failures are the norm in big systems. Because the regular stuff has to just work properly, because otherwise you won't be able to get things done. So you write software to cope with the failures, because they're the things that stop you being able to scale the number of things that you can manage with a fixed number of people. The second is, if you're not locking down what kind of quality of service you're giving your customers, you're really not helping them. It does not make their life better to say, we've got a system that occasionally goes faster. You have to be able to specify how often, under what circumstances, it will or will not go faster. And that provokes a whole bunch of new design questions. It turns out that making systems more predictable is often far more valuable than making them fast. Let's try this again. Making systems more predictable is far more valuable than making them go fast. This is mostly the opposite of what many software engineer developers are trying to achieve. And I've hinted at this, but we didn't really have a chance to talk about it, but I think the next big thing that's going to be the barrier to us deploying enough systems fast enough to do what we want is our inability to treat configuration as a first-class problem rather than as something we hold together with bright people, string, sealing wax, and duct tape. I didn't have a statement up the front about what I can't do, but I do have the fact that we're hiring as the way to end. Thanks, everybody. Be happy to answer questions.
So based on that last slide, most configuration systems, if not all of them, are declarative. You should run this and this and this, and you have all of these. What's the next direction in configuration management? Can we learn from biological systems where entities know what to do based on the one beside them? With no
perhaps,
explicit configuration.
As some slightly overexcited reporter just recently published, we are living in a world of emergent behavior for most of our computer systems, and the register, if you care. Otherwise, I wouldn't recommend it. I think it's going to be a combination of a number of different things. We've sort of swung from let's do everything imperatively to, that hurt. Let's do everything declarative. That hurts too. We need a tasteful mix of the two together with perhaps constraints. The declarative stuff can be used for specifying constraints on how far the emergent behavior or the information you can use from your colleagues or the next system over can be allowed to cause you to migrate within some space. So put bounds for safety reasons on some kind of space that you want to operate in. And then you want to be able to use other things. I think actually machine learning is going to be the big win here, trying to take advantage of a much more fine-grained and high-fidelity understanding of prior behavior as a predictor of the future. It turns out we do a lot of stuff over and over again. The number of times there is something spectacularly new is relatively small. So I think there is hope in that space. So I would probably look to the machine learning community before I look to the biologists. But, biologists sounds more fun.
So my question is sort of related to that. It's been known in the resource management community for a long time that scheduling isn't quite the knapsack problem. It's the knapsack problem with a bunch of liars giving you things to put into your backpack,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what I'm really wondering is for your workloads, how good are your estimates of runtime, resource consumption, and all that sort of stuff? We know they're terrible on HPC batch systems, but...
So let me separate your question, if I may, into two parts. How good are the people who provide us estimates? I'll give you a small teaser or hint. It turns out we tell them one additional thing I forgot to mention, which is that if they submit a request for a job and it needs more resources than they asked for, we'll kill it. So they are actually extremely good at picking the set of resources that is big enough so their jobs do not get killed. And that turns out to be a lousy estimate of what they will actually do in practice. The systems that run those, the automated systems that measure and monitor and look at and use historical data to predict stuff, turn out to be pretty good. And they're good enough that we're now migrating more and more stuff onto the completely automatic choice of resource amounts. Now, the price you pay is, if it's a new thing, you have no idea, right? So, but you do exactly what a person would do. I'm going to try running this and see if it falls over. Huh, that didn't work. Give it twice as much. Just binary chop is your friend. But the systems can do it for you, and they can do it in parallel, and they can get hints from the last time you did this. And as they get slowly more sophisticated, they actually do today rather crude machine learning techniques, but I think they will get better and better. They're sort of age-weighting the recent releases are more useful than the previous ones. There's something related to the size of the input files, that kind of stuff. But I think we'll get, as we take more parameters into account, we'll be able to do better and better jobs. It doesn't need to be perfect. It needs to be just good enough to be able to get slightly better bin packing, because we do have spare resources and slightly fewer rates of mistakes for preemptions.
Thanks.
Sure.
Hi. As someone who's been using SunGrid Engine for many years, all of these terms that you're talking about are really familiar, right? And we have the same sort of thing, the cell manager, the execution host, the same problems with job specification and UI and error messages. So what are the primary reasons you had to write your own? Why couldn't you use an existing system that used all those same terms?
Maybe we didn't have to. This happened before I joined the company, so I cannot answer your question. I could hypothesize based on what was happening, but I won't. All right, thanks everybody.